Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Claudio Califano and David Spinks, welcome to the Exagility podcast.
Thank you. We're really glad to be here.
We're really pleased to be here, John. Thanks for inviting us.
I'm here today to review your book, Adopting Agile Across Borders, a guide to navigating cultural complexity in agile teams and organizations. And I was really intrigued from reading the book, and I'm delighted that you're here today to help us walk through it. Cool. So what I'm really curious about is, before you even got to this book, maybe something about yourself. So for the audience, David, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and how someone could write a book on this topic, for example?
Sure. Yeah, my background was actually as a software developer. I was a programmer for about 10 years before I discovered Agile. I was at a company and the company decided that we were going to adopt Scrum and Agile ways of working, and I became a Scrum master. So it wasn't really something that I was seeking, but found my passion, something that I really enjoy doing. So I worked with various teams and organizations with agility since then. That was around about 2012. And I think part of what I started to recognize with the different teams and organizations I was working at, just this mix of diversity of different teams, different personalities, these sorts of things. And I met Claudia around about 2013. And that's when we started to have these discussions around cultural differences. So maybe I'll let Claudia pick up the story of how we met.
Yeah, so like David said, we met in about 2013.
I think, yeah.
Something like that. And we ended up working at the same company. So yeah, so my name was Claudia. I'm half Dutch, half Italian, lived most of my life in the Netherlands, but moved over to the UK about 15, 16 years ago. And when I moved over to the UK, I changed my career and I ended up in Scrum teams, actually. I was a developer as well. That was quite a big change. And then I met David in 2013 when I started working as a Scrum Master at the same company where he worked. And then indeed, maybe I'll just talk a bit about going into that automatically about why we were so interested in culture and what actually kicked off this discussion and the book and our travels, etc. So like I said, I was raised in the Netherlands, but my dad was Italian, my mum was Dutch, been raised in quite an Italian way, I would say. Then moved over to the UK. And although those are all three countries like within Europe, it's still such a cultural difference. And I think I wasn't expecting when I moved over to the UK that there would be so much difference. And I really had to adapt. And I'm already here 15, 16 years, and I still have to laugh about the little nuances and differences there are, and also how it actually changed me in my behavior. Can I now go back to the Netherlands? I do notice that certain behaviors I have really adapted from my life now in the UK. Working in the agile space, then that got me thinking. We talk about being able to adapt, but also have the courage to actually do the right thing, being open, etc. And how do these values, for example, or these expectations, what we want to do in agile, how does that work in other cultures? Because we maybe some people are less comfortable in certain cultures to have the courage, or maybe there's more hierarchy, which means that we teams are less empowered. So it was just questions that we thought about. We found on the internet certain people saying, oh, this agile doesn't work in my country. And we thought, is that actually the case or not? And that's how we started.
Yeah, it reminds me of a story from a retired lady I was training during the week in an advanced Scrum Master class. And she was very funny, very wise, and very well read, so well prepared. And it was almost a test for me, actually. She was so smart. And one of the things she said to me was, is Scrum not set up for failure, expecting everyone to be open?
Yeah.
Because some people don't want to be open. And depending on the country you're in or the culture you're in, that could or not be the case. And that actually brings up the topic of culture, actually, because I'm very interested in culture, people and change in particular. I remember back in 2010, one of my sponsors said to me, don't they teach you agile people anything about people and change? And at the time, I didn't know much about it. So I did a lot of study on it. And I read loads of books on culture, but one of the authors in particular, Edgar Schein, said that culture is the set of assumptions written and unwritten. And I kind of really liked that. There are other versions as well, of course, but I noticed in your book, if we are going to talk about culture, it'd be important that we understand what it is. And you might have a slightly different view. But I noticed that at the very start of the book that you did talk about what culture was. And you had some visuals actually in terms of ethnics, background, religion, region, all sorts of other factors that you took into account. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think when we look at culture, it's one word, but it's a big subject, isn't it? And I think the thing about culture is there's many different layers to it. There's not just where you are, where you live, where you're born, where you're raised. That's part of it, yes. But there's all sorts of other factors as well. I might live and work in the same place, but maybe I've had a different educational background, or maybe I work in the same country, but I'm working a different professional from somebody else. There's all these different layers: our nationality, generational differences, our religious beliefs, different regions within countries. An example of one of the countries that we visited is Indonesia, which is spread over a vast area, but has got thousands of islands. So there's thousands of subcultures within that one country, for example. Geography plays a part, our educational background, our profession. And then when we think about the workplace, we've got the different corporate culture as well, and that has an influence. So us as individuals have our culture. We've also got the corporate culture as well, and that keeps things intertwined as well. So when you start digging into it, it's very complex. When you asked earlier what made us qualified for this, I think it was just our curiosity. Like, similar as you said, it was as an agile practitioner, you start looking at how people interact. So you realize the importance of people in interactions. And then you start asking that question, what does it mean for people's own personal sort of views or their own personal cultures, really? And that's why we started digging into it. It was the curiosity that kind of led us on this journey.
Indeed. And I have the page here and referred to national, generational, religious, regional, personal, ethnic, corporate, educational, and professional. So there are different lenses through which you looked at this. And of course, the danger with culture, looking at culture from a national point of view as well, regional point of view, is we end up with stereotypes. And me being Irish, for example, I'm probably getting drunk all the time and things like that, stuff like that. And it does kind of stick, doesn't it? They're useful, but they can be quite damaging. But I noticed very quickly in the book that you were aware of that danger and you started looking at some models. And one of them was, I can't pronounce the name, I think it's Hofstede. And then it was a Lewis model. Can you tell us a little bit more about those models and why you looked at those to help you with this?
Yeah, like I said, the Hofstede model is probably the most well-known. We dug more into the Lewis model, which is very much focused because we felt that model fitted very well with what we wanted to discover about culture and agile and how that was impacted. And the Lewis model is all very much about communication, decision-making, negotiation, collaboration. So it has that behavioral aspect very much intertwined in it. That's why we felt that was very suitable. So the model actually is based on research that Lewis, then his name is, did over the years. He is a linguist to start with and also a cultural expert. And he'd done a lot of surveys, a lot of traveling. He worked in Japan, I think, for a long time as well, and all across the world. And the model is very based on, I think, about more than 150,000 surveys and talking to people, etc., etc. And based on that, he came up with a model that plots certain behaviors. And he came up with three categories, which is multi-active, reactive, and David has to remind me.
Linear active.
Now, what that means, I know that's three categories, and then you think, oh, you're boxing people in three categories. That's not really what he does. So, for example, you can do a test, for example, or do the survey, and it could come up that I end up having a lot of multi-active characteristics, but also reactive and linear active. Yeah. So when I did the survey, I'm very multi-active, which means I interrupt people. But that's from my passion, because I'm very passionate. And when we're talking, when interrupt people to say, we have a conversation, I go, wow, from the excitement. So sometimes people, like when I look here, in now I live in the UK, I think that's considered being very rude. You know what I mean? When you're interrupting constantly. But if you have a bunch of multi-active people together, that goes for passion and conversation. Yeah, it's an interest. So it's much more about those behaviors, for example, liking doing a lot of things at the same time. When you look at reactive, it's being really comfortable with silence. So some people are very comfortable with silence and want to reflect and take time. So it's the behaviors that are in those categories. That doesn't mean that one person is in one category. That's just impossible.
I think one thing that we found during our initial research, we were very aware that we didn't want to stereotype and those sorts of issues that you mentioned, John. But I think what we recognized was we get a lot of clashes, especially within Scrum teams. Any group dynamics, you're going to get clashes between people. And part of that is because of these differences that we have as people. And that is part of our culture, really. It's a fine line of stereotyping. But yet, these models, they do provide some useful tools to us to explore our differences, really. And that's where we start looking at the Hofstadter and things like the Lewis to bring out and start to try to have the discussion around the fact that actually we do have different ways of behaving. So it's not just about the fact that you're German or Japanese, but actually we need to recognize that we've all got our own individual cultures, and that is leading to some of the misunderstandings that we have.
Indeed. And I really enjoyed the book. And for example, it goes through the different regions. It starts off with South America and gives a little bit of background about South America and then goes into Argentina. And what I like about the structure of the book is you start off with just giving people a sense of what it's like to be in the place. And then you go into the history and then you come up with some movements or companies in that country that happen to be practicing agility in some form. And you interview some people from them and you find some key insights. That was the kind of the rhythm. Then you went on to Chile and into the history of Chile and the same thing again. I got into the rhythm after a while in the book where, okay, I'm going to get a history lesson first. And that's really good because it gives me some context. And actually, sometimes I'm not really fully familiar with the history of that country. So it's actually helping me as well to get the kind of lowdown. So in terms of like the history for each country and all that, like how did you know you're getting something reasonably reliable? Because that's a tricky subject, isn't it? Where to get that information? How did you get your heads around that one?
Yeah, that was probably one of the biggest challenges of producing the book. We started the research back in 2018.
Yeah.
In fact, 2017 is when we first had the idea and started doing our research. We started traveling in 2018 and we didn't get the book out until last year, like halfway through 2021. When we started writing, we thought, oh, this will be a 6-month project. So a lot of it was going into the research and a big part of that was looking at the history and things. So lots of reading, verifying sources and things. So not just finding things from Wikipedia, but going and backing that up with different things. So yeah, in the book, we make references to a lot of the research material that we used to study the history as well. We're not historians, and say we do cover a lot of countries within the book, so it's fair to say we skim the surface, but as you say, the point was to try to give a flavor of why some of the cultural aspects might be as they are, because again, history is one of those factors that to help contribute to our culture.
We also had a very good editor from our publisher, to be fairly honest, so he helped as well.
And there's a lot of countries in the book, and the sequence of the book, is that the sequence that you traveled, or what way did it work? Where did you start your travels? Let's put it that way.
It's actually interesting. It is a sequence. Now, I don't think I realized that myself, but I think it is a sequence how we traveled. We did start in Argentina and we made our way through South America. And then we went into Asia, and then after that, Europe. So yeah, it is actually the sequence of the book. Not sure, did we do that on purpose, David, or was that just by accident?
I don't know. It must be a subconscious thing, I think. So in terms of the countries, they are done in alphabetical order for each continent. So yeah, it happens just to be Argentina was the first, and begins with the name.
So we started in South America, and I think there's a couple of things. I think there wasn't that much known about Agile in South America. I think it's really up and coming now, but when we went in 2017, 2018, it was not as big as it is in here, like here in USA or in the UK or etc. And I think we started in Argentina, and we are so glad that we started in Argentina, because what happened the week that we were in Buenos Aires, all the board members from Agile Alliance for the first time came to South America to talk about Agile. And we were very pleased that we were allowed to join that breakfast meeting. And that's where we met straight away a lot of people of the South American Agile community, which opened the doors to being invited to some amazing companies. And I think once your invite is one or two companies, other companies will follow and other people will follow. So we were very, very lucky with that.
And did you find that people were really open in the interviews, or did that actually depend on the country that you're in?
I think it depended on the company, the country a bit as well. I think what we had in Argentina and also in Uruguay, actually a lot of South American companies, we even had people saying, oh, just go and sit here for a couple of days with your laptop. You can work here and you can just talk to people. So where we started, it was very actually open. We even had in Chile when we visited a bank there that wasn't like, oh, just sit here. Of course, we can sort financial. Still more security, but still was very open. You know what I mean? Still, yeah, come and visit us. And so we did. But I think it depended really also on the company itself, I think.
I think as well, we had different ways of gathering the qualitative data. Part of it was observing, so watching teams during their Scrum events, for example, or even just being in the office, as Claudia says. And we carried out a lot of one-to-one interviews with Scrum Masters, Agile coaches, product owners, but also people working in the teams. It was like a mixture of observation and interviews that allowed us to gather data that gave us a feel for what was going on in some of the different companies. I'll be honest, there were some places where, again, they would just give us a glossy sort of, this is what we do here. And again, yeah. We know that it was relatively obvious to sniff out when, you know, it's sounds too good to be true almost.
Yeah, so. It probably is. Yeah. Yeah. And you visited a lot of countries in South America. You were in Argentina, Chile, Colombia, and Uruguay. And in Asia, you're in India, Indonesia, Japan, the Philippines, Singapore, and United Arab Emirates. And then in Europe, you were in Germany, the Netherlands, Poland, United Kingdom. And then in Africa, you were in South Africa and West Africa. And it was interesting that I was actually helping a guy last week in the United States, a senior leader, and he was struggling with his teams a little bit in South Africa. And they were wonderful people, but there were cultural differences. And I pointed him to your book, actually, saying, actually, maybe you might want to check this book out, Adopting Agile Across Borders, because it might give you some insights, particularly in South Africa. There would be really rich diversity in terms of culture, microcultures, and so on. Can you tell us maybe a few stories from some of these countries that kind of brought to light the key differences you would have seen maybe in your travels around the world?
One example I always talk about is, so we spent a month in Japan, and that was really interesting. But a lot of times when we talk in Agile, people talk about hierarchy and like hierarchy, how does that impact agility? How does it impact Agile teams? Does it impact empowerment, et cetera, et cetera? And what I noticed, like a lot of Japanese companies, overall, the culture is very hierarchical. Now, I'm from the Netherlands, where overall, the company cultures are very flat structured compared to that. And what I did notice, though, what both countries actually, or both a lot of companies in both countries had in common, is that we're very much focused on consensus building. And it isn't just the hierarchy, it's the decision making within that that actually maybe is very impactful. What I'm trying to say is, like, when I read the Hofstede model, for example, or other models, we say Argentina is more hierarchical than the Netherlands, for example, the companies in there. But their communication is very horizontal in a way, and their decision making is different. So what I noticed, for example, in Japan and the Netherlands, so though hierarchically completely different, both very much built on consensus building. And actually, what impact does that have on Agile? Because like in Agile teams, we want decisions. In the Scrum team, we have a product owner because we don't want that decision by committee and dragging out and things like that. So will actually that long consensus building slow us down with regards to agility? Or... And then it got me thinking, of course, then you have a look at project versus product. So in projects, building that consensus behind the scenes and building that up could actually speed up your project. Because as soon as you start your project, everyone is on board, everyone is aligned, everyone agrees, bang, you go through it. But when we want to move to product, would that actually hold us back? That was just very interesting. So it's more the decision-making. So for people who are in a very consensus-building environment, suddenly go to a company where decision-making is much more, if I look here in the UK, it's although we're flatter structured than Japan, our decision-making is still feels a bit more top-down. I thought that was really interesting because I wasn't expecting that. I was just expecting from reading the books, it's all about hierarchy, and I wasn't expecting about the impact of decision-making that actually within the hierarchy can still be different as well in the communication. Horizontal, vertical communication, top-down decision-making, consensus building. So,
yeah.
Well, I think one of the great things that being able to publish the book gave us was we were able to give a platform for agile practitioners, other people working within these organizations to tell their own stories. So the book does include lots of stories, case studies of people in their own voice. One that kind of jumped out at me as you asked the question was from a lady called Kwezi. She's in South Africa. And she talked about her piece is titled Finding My Voice. So she talks about the challenges as a woman working in IT industry, how she's heard, because in South Africa, they've got something called the BE, the Black Economic Empowerment, which is basically within an organization, we have to hire so many people to correct some of the injustices that have been done in the past. Essentially, you can imagine the sort of fallout of that that might happen within an organization. So she talks about as a woman working within the IT industry, the challenges that she faces and the courage that she needs to show to speak out and talk about the challenges that she sees. I think that was a really courageous and a very interesting story that she shared with us, which is in the book.
There's something else I noticed in the book as well to do with retrospectives. I guess this comes into kind of meeting patterns, but in Scrum, for example, there's a retrospective, and I guess a decent Kanban team would probably be doing retrospectives as well. Most good agile teams would probably retrospect regularly to see, are we doing okay as a team and so on. And in some countries, I've noticed that when I do a retrospective, I need to start with the positive. You don't just start with the negative. But then you go to Germany, for example, and we know we're good. Let's focus on getting better. So we're wasting time here talking about what we're good at. Let's focus on what we need to improve. And so I'm wondering how much of that you noticed in your own travels. It might have been just the companies I was with, I don't know. But did you notice patterns like that where some things in retrospectives, maybe you don't need to go there, or maybe you do need to go pay special attention to certain topics in other cultures? Have you got some examples maybe?
Yeah, so I think one example is in certain companies and certain countries, the relationships between people, it's almost like your colleagues are your friends. There's not that much separation between work and home life. It's much more intertwined in certain cultures that we discovered. What you then get in your retrospective is that thought, oh, that's really good. So people know each other, they feel comfortable, they feel safe, all going to be really open. And actually, it's a bit the contrary, because people don't want to offend their friends or their family. You know what I mean? So they will hold back on certain things because that's what they said. Actually, openness with regard to that, they just don't want to offend anyone. So it's much more careful how you have that retro, that you still get the improvement items out without offending anyone. And I don't know, David, if you want to add something to it.
Yeah, it was interesting. We have one story from Iona in the book, and she's working with teams in Poland. And she talks about, as you say, like, the workplace is the workplace. This is a serious place. And she talks about retrospectives, which is, say, focused on getting better. And she's contrasted that with some of the teams that she's worked with in the UK, where retrospectives might be focused on fun. So team building, those sorts of things. And from the cultural point of view, from teams in Poland and around East Europe as well, we're not here to have fun. We're here to be professional. So they were confused by these sorts of retrospective formats, which was about team building or having fun. Yeah, they were like, let's just get down to business. They're massively fun people, but there's a much clearer separation between the workplace and being professional versus where we would do the team building, but more informally, beer and pizza, that's fine for us. We don't need to do these sort of fun retrospective activities to bond. So that was an interesting contrast.
Okay. And that reminds me as well, particularly what Claudia said about healthy conflict. I'm thinking of the five dysfunctions of a team. And one of the dysfunctions is the lack of healthy conflict, debating about ideas. Apparently, Patrick Lencioni's office, they're screaming at each other. They're not having personal differences. They're genuinely trying to find the best idea. And that kind of helps them to overcome obstacles and hopefully get better results and so on. Do some cultures have coping strategies to get around that? If they struggle to have that healthy conflict in a group setting, have you noticed that they manage to get around that in some other way where they do get to improve, they do get to find the right ideas, but they do it without necessarily doing it the Patrick Lencioni way where we're debating the ideas? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think there's two extremes. There's one where there's not enough conflict, and I'll be looking at some of the cultures and maybe the likes of Japan, where a lot of the group interactions is all about harmony and ceremony. And maybe there's not enough challenge of each other in the formal settings, but they've got something called nemawashi, which is essentially a way of building consensus, but it's very informal. So outside of the meetings, outside of the formal touch points, it's little conversations by the water cooler in the corridor, and it's building up consensus that almost by stealth. So it's an interesting way to get people all on board. It's very powerful because ultimately the consensus is built within that group of people. However, it takes time. So that's one of the drawbacks with that approach. If you contrast that with maybe another culture where it'll be bring everybody together and we're going to have a meeting, a discussion, and we've got a strict agenda and we want an outcome by the end, that might be a lot more direct and in conflict. So we might see that more in the UK or the US, for example. Part of that is just the different consensus building techniques is interesting.
But then I'm just thinking, David, for if you look like the strict agenda and the outcome, then you've got the contrary. Maybe you get a fast decision, but are actually people behind it? Are there people then in the meeting who feel pushed? So if I just look at my experience, like for me personally, in a group setting, I'm not very good in a big group meeting. And I always feel pushed into a decision. And I'll probably give in. But I do give in when I come out of a meeting thinking, I don't agree with this at all. I'm not committed to this at all. You need to have that.
Yep. And this is where leadership styles come in as well. Saying in some cultures, it's much more authoritarian and say maybe a leader is pulling rank to get to a decision or something or to dissolve that conflict. Whereas in other cultures, some of the South American ones or in Asia, leaders are more paternal. They're there to be more supportive, to walk people through things, to help support. So again, I think that leadership style is a part of it as well.
And plus decision-making comes back again. That drives behaviours as well. So if beforehand you agree, for example, we all need a unanimous decision, that can cause certain behaviours as well. It could cause behaviours that people feel pushed into it, but the upside is maybe that once people come out, they're all committed. And majority vote, there's all these different decision rules that you can have that will have an impact on the behaviour as well and how people behave in those meetings. So I think having that agreed up front as well in certain ways can help as well, I think. And being aware of what that means. If you do this decision rule, what are the downsides and what are the upsides?
Yeah. Another factor, as we've mentioned, is how the separation between professional versus private life. Claudia's mentioned that, but in some cultures, there's a clear separation. Parts of Europe, UK, US is more like that. People have their friends outside of work, whereas in the South Americas and Japan, maybe a little bit less so there, but people's colleagues, they are their friends. So again, the conflict management works differently. Again, maybe in some places that there's actually, they're trying to avoid conflict more because their work colleagues are their friends as well. So sometimes they avoid some conflict where maybe it might be necessary.
So I've got a confession and then I'd like to get your advice, okay? I break the rules of Scrum with the retrospective. Shock horror, professional Scrum trainer, breaking one of the rules of Scrum and the retrospective. So one of the things that I do is I've noticed that if I use all these fancy techniques, Esther Darby, five stages, all these kind of things, and do a beautiful retrospective. But I got fed up of time after time of seeing teams not actually improving at all. So I changed tack a few years ago. And what I do now is, whatever fancy techniques I might use are not fancy at all. Sometimes I call them drive-through retrospectives, like the quick ones. But within 20 minutes, we'll figure out what the problems are. We know what the issues are anyway in the team. And some of them are within the control or influence of the team, and some of them are not. So the ones that are not within their control or influence, I need to take that away as a scrum master or a leader and try and help the team to get them overcome. But there'll be some things that the team can hopefully resolve themselves. And so what I say to the team, and this is where I break the rules, there's a time box. You could wrap it up at that stage, agree the improvements and agree when you're going to act on them in the retrospective and move on. But what I do is I say, okay, you've got an hour and 10 minutes left and let's fix something right now. And they look at me and go, what? Yeah, I want you to fix something right now. I said, you've got 10 things in your list there. If you just fix one thing, I'll be a happy guy and you'll be happy too, because next sprint that'll be gone and then we'll have other problems. And what I find is when I look back after a few months and when they look back after a few months and I make sure it's part of the agenda for the retrospective that they do look back, they see that they actually did make improvements. But this is where I need your advice now. So which countries should I avoid when I'm doing that? Or maybe it's too tricky.
I think your approach, they're probably already doing it well in the likes of the Netherlands. So yeah. I think very much doers there, aren't they? Like Claudia being Dutch will verify this. But I think there's some folks that are very practical there. I don't know, where would that be difficult?
I can't even come up where that would be difficult. I think it would be like quite a global thing. I don't know. We're just thinking. What do you think, David?
I can maybe see some issues in maybe in towards the Middle East or in the Far East, where perhaps there's more a concept of needing permission to do things. Yeah. Again, maybe you could do that if there's things that the team have got control of. But if we're now starting to talk about organizational impediments, I think culturally there's this awareness of we need to get permission from the leader to actually make changes. So I think that's more of something that we would see more in some of the reactive cultures that I mentioned, your Indonesia's, your Japan, certainly UAE, those sorts of places.
Thank you. I'd probably reserve that request for impediments that are within the control influence of the team. And I would take away whatever needs to be dealt with afterwards. And yeah, but thank you for that advice. That's useful to know. I can give it a go in a few countries. And if I get something thrown at me in some retrospective, I'll let you know. And maybe feature in the second edition of the book or something. So there are a lot of countries in the book. There's also a lot of countries not in the book. Something put a stop to your gallop. I'm guessing it was COVID. Was it COVID, or was it just always the plan that these were going to be the countries that you're going to look at?
I think COVID did stop some of the traveling. And I think we just wanted to have certain countries in, ideally in each continent. We did, for example, visit Australia as well, but we don't actually have Australia in the book, I think, because we only visited one or two people there and we didn't feel like we had enough data for it to really go through that. But yeah, it was COVID who stopped Europe. I think we were happy with the countries in Southeast Asia and in South America. And then we came back and we were planning to do Europe. And that's actually where we felt that's COVID.
I think I would add as well, because we were using the Lewis model as a basis for our research, that was what we were thinking about in the back of our minds. We were looking at countries to make sure that we would cover those three bases of the Lewis model.
Yeah.
Again, we would have loved to have kept going. Our travel, our research was entirely self-funded. While we were traveling, I think people were looking at us and thinking we had this sort of backing behind us and we were staying in glamorous places. We were not. We were staying in some interesting places. And again, that's my British cultural trait there, saying interesting. So that's another way of saying cockroach infested. We even had people saying, oh yeah, thanks for visiting, are you staying at the Hilton or the Ritz? And no, we're staying at a boutique hotel, we would say. There was a limit to the number of places we could go. Like I say, we wanted to make sure that we covered the basis of the Lewis model, but also as our research was growing, we started building momentum, and some of the companies that we were visiting would then make recommendations and say, hey, do you know these folks in this company in this country? So we were going a little bit toward basically being guided based on recommendations as well for us to talk to.
And then with regards to South Africa and West Africa, that was all done remotely. So we did all those interviews remotely. We do work a lot with a company in West Africa anyway, so remotely as well. So we do workshops there and stuff, because that indeed was the one that we would travel to next. And that was COVID as well. But those were all done remotely. But yeah, Europe, we did visit, of course, we didn't visit the companies in the Netherlands, but I'm from the Netherlands myself. So I worked a lot of companies in the Netherlands. But then we interviewed, again, people still from the Netherlands.
Well, lovely. It's a really nice book. And I've been recommending it to people ever since I've read it. I think I've recommended it three times already this week to people who have been attending my training or people asking for me to help them coaching or consulting. So it's Adopting Agile Across Borders, A Guide to Navigating Cultural Complexity in Agile Teams and Organizations by Claudia Califano and David Spinks. And I want to thank you both very much for coming on to the Exagility podcast, and looking forward to seeing more books from you again in the future.
Cool. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you for having us, John. Thank you.